Exodus 19:1 through 19:25. The 21st talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on June 22, 1997 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1997. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to return to Exodus. Exodus chapter 19. I started in Exodus teaching over a year ago, and my intention is to finish in the next 5 weeks or so. Today I'm going to go through Exodus 19, which is God's presentation of the law. He's going to prepare them for the law. Next week I plan to just make some summary comments about the law in general. And then the 2 weeks following that, I want to finish up the historical narrative section of Exodus. So we won't spend a lot of time on the law, and yet the law is about 17 chapters of what remains. But today I want to talk about God's preparation for the presentation of the law to the people of Israel. And before I get into it, I'd like to refresh your memories about what's going on in Exodus and what has happened up to now. If you will recall, God had given a promise to Abraham, someone that God had selected for no reason in particular. We don't know why God selected Abraham. There's no reason given. God just said, I'm going to bless you. And God said that blessing would come in the form of a people. God was going to make Abraham into a people for God. And he would give to that people a land, and that land was going to be Palestine or Canaan. Well, Abraham did live in that land, but then his descendants left Canaan because of famine and moved into Egypt, where food was available, and lived there for about 400 years, during which time they were enslaved. And they grew in numbers, but continued to be enslaved right up until the time of the Exodus. But at that time, after 400 years, God finally decided to move on the promise that he had made to Abraham, to give to his, to make Abraham's descendants into a people, and to give them the land that he had promised to Abraham. And he raised up a man by the name of Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses was born at a time when the Egyptians were putting to death all the young males born to the Hebrews. But Moses was spared and, in fact, was raised in the household of Pharaoh himself. But then Moses ended up murdering an Egyptian and fled into the desert, where he lived for 40 years until God appeared to him and brought Moses back to Egypt to lead his people out of the land. God had so hardened Pharaoh's heart that Pharaoh was not receptive to the idea of the Hebrews leaving. And so God inflicted on Egypt a series of 10 plagues. And finally, with great reluctance, Pharaoh said, okay, get out of here. And the Israelites fled. And they fled to the edge of the desert with their back against the sea. And Pharaoh changed his mind and came after the Egyptians. And with really no place for the Israelites to go, God opened up the waters of the Red Sea, and the Israelites passed through. As the Egyptians pursued after them, God brought the waves in and drown them, put them to death. So then the Israelites were free from the Egyptians, but they were in the desert. And there were not the provisions in the desert for this number of people. But God did provide for them. First of all, he led them through the desert by means of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. He also provided for their food needs by sending manna from heaven and quail. And at times he miraculously provided water by bringing water from the rock. So God provided for their needs throughout this journey through the desert. But nevertheless, the Israelites, true to form, grumbled constantly. They were constantly afraid that either God would not adequately care for them because he couldn't, or because he didn't care about them, one or the other. But in fact, God did provide for them, and they made their way to Mount Sinai in the desert. And that's where chapter 19 begins. I'll read the first three verses and then make some comments. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel the following." So this is in the third month, so it's only 2 months after they had left from Egypt. So we're just beginning into the third month. So they've been gone for 2 months, which isn't an awfully long time. And in fact, the plagues most likely only lasted about 9 months. So it's been a total of about a year, not quite a year, since Moses first came to the Pharaoh and said, "Let us go." So all of this activity has really been crammed into a fairly short period of time, less than a year. And here they are now at Mount Sinai. And it says in verse 2 that the Israelites camped at the foot of the mountain. And then, as if by contrast, it says, "And Moses went up to God." So the picture is we've got the Israelites setting up their tents at the foot of the mountain. And Moses, barely stopping, he takes off on a hike up the mountain. Moses had to have been rather excited at this particular point. Because if you will recall, when God first appeared to Moses in the burning bush, it was on Mount Sinai. And God made a promise to him at that time. If you look back at Exodus 3:12, I believe it is. Yes. If you'll recall, God appeared to Moses in this burning bush, and he said, "I want you to go back and lead your people out of Egypt." And Moses said, "Are you sure you got the right number? I mean, I don't think I'm the one. Are you sure it's me that you want to go do this? I don't think this is a good idea." And so they enter into these negotiations, kind of this exchange. Moses in verse 11 says to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" And here's God's response: "Certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain." So what God had told Moses is that there would be this sign that God was behind this whole activity. And when would this sign be seen? When would this sign be realized? When it's all over. And what would that sign be? The people of Israel would worship God at this very mountain. So there's a sense in which this is a point of culmination of the mission that Moses has been sent on. That God had said, when God spoke it must have been incredible. It must have been unbelievable to Moses that these people who are enslaved by the strongest nation in the world would be allowed to leave, and they'd come all the way to this mountain and they'd worship their own God. That must have seemed absolutely impossible to him. And yet God is saying, that will be the sign that I have been behind all this and have done all of this. And now it has come about. There must have been many times over the last year when Moses was thinking, I don't know how God can pull this out. I don't know how God can do this. But now, after a year, the people of Israel are at the mountain, just as God had said would happen. And Moses is sensing the completion of his mission. And instead of setting up his tent, he's running up the mountain in anticipation, apparently, of what God will do or say. Verses 4 through 6 we have God's words that he spoke to Moses when he did go up the mountain. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So God begins by reminding them of what he has done. First of all, what he did to the Egyptians, what he did to the most powerful nation on earth in order to make it possible for the Israelites to leave. And secondly, how I bore you on eagle's wings. In other words, the protection and guidance that God provided in what seemed to be an impossible situation. And brought you to myself. I think that means to the mountain that God had designated as the place where he would bring them. So he reminds them of all that he has done for them, and then he says, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own, or my special possession, among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. In other words, God is underscoring the fact that he is the God of the universe, the master of the universe, that all of the peoples in the world are under his subjection and control. However, he has selected one people out of all those peoples to be his special possession, and that is Israel. And he's saying, that is the position that I have reserved for you if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant. Then he indicates what the nature of that special possession is, that special relationship. What is the unique role of the people of Israel? You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This, when I looked at this verse, this has been very helpful to me to see why God gave the shape to the nation of Israel that he gave to it. What is a priest? In ancient religion, and this would be true of the Israelite religion as well as God sets it up, the priest has a very important role and special role in society. The priest, for one thing, proclaims God's word to the people. In the most ancient of times, priests were seen to be oracles who would speak God's word to the people. Later on, they were seen as teachers who would teach God's principles to the people. And by extension, they were also to live exemplary lives and thereby teach God's principles to his people. So, one part of their role is a didactic one, a function of informing the rest of the people what God requires of them. The other thing that they do is they enter into the realm of the sacred. And in the realm of the sacred, they make sacrifices on behalf of the people. They do what is necessary to make their people acceptable to God. So those two functions kind of come together in the sense that a priest is a mediator between profane man and God. And in order to do that role, perform that role, they have to be able to enter into both the profane world and into the sacred world. And as a result, there have to be special regulations for the priests. They have to lead a life that is different from the rest of their culture, abiding by certain special rules in order to qualify them for entering into the realm of the holy. And what God is saying is, Israel will be a kingdom of priests. That Israel will serve that function with respect to the rest of humanity in the same way that the Levitical priesthood served that function within the nation of Israel. So God is singling them out and making them into a special people, a people that can enter into the holy on the behalf of the rest of us and perform that service of mediating between us and God. So just as the Levitical priesthood had to abide by certain special rules that the rest of the Israelites did not have to, the nation of the Hebrews, the Israelites, will be asked to abide by certain special regulations. And that's kind of his rationale for an introduction to the law that's coming up. That's what God wants to make of them, is a kingdom of priests with respect to the rest of mankind. It's a very intriguing concept and a very honorable role that was given to the Israelites. Having said that, then, to Moses, Moses returns then to the people of Israel and gives them the following instructions, starting in verse 7. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord also said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, 'Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain.'" So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman." So Moses comes down and relays this information to the people of Israel, and their response is, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Famous last words. They weren't able to pull it off, but that was their response to it. And this is very understandable, and it's very human. What God is saying to them is, "I am going to make you into a special possession of mine." And they have to be able to, and God has encouraged them to reflect back on what God has done for them to make it possible for them to reach this mountain. God has done amazing things. And this, they probably saw this as anticipation or a promise that God would continue to provide that kind of guidance and protection into the future indefinitely. And God is offering to make them a special possession of His if they're willing to obey by His commandments. So their response is, I think quite naturally, yes, we'll do whatever you say. But they don't know what God is going to ask of them. This is kind of a blank check that they are signing. But it has been my experience that blank checks are really the most rewarding things that we have in our life. It's when we make a commitment that is right and we do everything within our power to abide by that commitment. When you think of some of the main blank checks that we sign in our lives, marriage is obviously one of them. You are taking oaths with a future that's unknown. No one can predict what's going to happen in a marriage. And yet you're committing yourself, come hell or high water, I am hanging in there. And that's a real blank check. And yet, taking that commitment seriously and working to do everything necessary, everything that you possibly can to make that work out, is a very rewarding feeling. There's a sense of, I did what I had committed myself to do. One of the things that happens when we sign those blank checks is we end up in circumstances which are really more than we can cope with, humanly speaking. And it is inevitable, it seems to me, in those kinds of situations that we find ourselves falling on our knees before God and saying, God, help me. And that's a very healthy situation to be in, a very healthy posture to have. Another blank check is children. You never know what's going to come out. You don't know what that child is going to do. You don't know what's going to happen to that child. You don't know what kind of heartache that child could bring you. And there are lots of different varieties of heartache that children can bring us. You just look around and see. And yet, on the other hand, there's little that's more rewarding than being devoted to a child, being responsible with respect to that child, and raising them up to be mature and independent adults. So there's something good and proper about entering into committing yourself to something that is good and proper, even though you don't know what all the fine details are going to be. So they can't be faulted for saying, whatever you say, we will do it. They can only be faulted for not carrying through on what they had said. God comes to them. God says that He's going to come to them in a thick cloud in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, that is Moses, and also may believe in you, Moses, forever. Up to now, Moses has been the go-between between the people of Israel and God. Moses would receive a word from God and then he would transmit it to the people of Israel. They have not been hearing from him directly. So they've been taking it on Moses' word that he is speaking what God had told him to say. At this point now, God has said, I am going to appear in a cloud and speak to them directly so that they know that this is my voice, that I am the one speaking. And then it goes on to say, and may also believe in you forever. That's a curious statement, because the Israelites clearly did not accept and did not obey the law that Moses recorded for them to follow forever. But there's another sense in which Moses's statements from God communicated to the people of Israel have endured. and in fact were reading them. So there's a sense in which God did put his stamp of approval on those words of Moses, and they have remained for us forever. Now God has Moses take the people through a series of steps to consecrate themselves, some things that they are supposed to do: wash their garments, set a boundary around the mountain. Apparently, verse 15, they're to refrain from sex for the 3 days in preparation for the presentation of the law. And then it talks about anyone who going up onto the mountain, crossing over those bounds, must be put to death. I think God is serious here. I think he means these to be taken seriously. And this is difficult because in our day and age, we are, it seems to me, so secular-minded that these kinds of rituals of ritualistic cleansing, various things that people do to render themselves holy with respect to God, that seems strange to us. And yet, I think that these rituals are important for us to take note of and to take seriously. As I understand it, what God is doing when he sets up the nation of Israel and gives them the rules that he gives them, especially with respect to how to be holy, how to be a separate people, is God is trying to paint a picture of what holiness is. If you think about it, here's God. He creates a people, and he wants this people to understand who he is. And one of his attributes is holiness. How does he communicate that concept to the people? And what he does in the Hebrew, in the Israelite culture, is he essentially establishes these the equivalent of manipulatives in mathematics. With our children, when we're teaching them to add, we have these little blocks. And you take two blocks here and three blocks here, and then you stick them all together, and then they count them. And sure enough, it turns out to be 5, which is the same as 2 plus 3. It's something very visual. It's something that they can see. It's something that they can handle. They can feel it. And they can understand addition in a way that's very visual and very tactile. God, in setting up the nation of Israel, is doing a similar kind of thing. How do you tell people what holiness is? Well, the way he communicates that is he sets up these rituals that have to be followed in order to make yourself holy. It's a sense of otherness, a sense of different from the profane, different from the everyday. And it's something that God takes very seriously. So he asked them to go through these rituals in order to prepare themselves for this thing that's going to happen. The only thing that I can think of in my experience that's similar to this is when I was very young, we lived in a small town, and occasionally we would, about once a week or so, we'd go into the big city, which was Salem. And I remember whenever we went into the big city, I had to dress up. That meant I had to put on a clean t-shirt with stripes on it, and I had to put on my clean jeans with the cuffs, with the 4-inch cuffs. But there was something about that that made going to the city seemed more elevated. There was something special about it. There was something significant about it. And just doing that every time I went to the city impressed upon me, yes, this is something special. This is something different. And I think a similar thing is going on here. God is saying, there is something really significant happening here. And I am going to impress that upon you. I want you to do these things and if you go up on the mountain, you'll be put to death. Then the event itself, starting in verse 16, "So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. And the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down, warn the people, lest they perish through to the Lord to gaze.'" Let me read that again. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down, warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them.' And Moses said to the Lord, 'The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou didst warn us, saying, Set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it.' Then the Lord said to him, 'Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break forth upon them.' So Moses went down to the people and told them." This must have been quite a sight. There are all kinds of things happening on this mountain at the same time. The cloud descends. There's fire that's going up. The mountain quakes. And a voice booms out of the cloud. And there's smoke rising. It must have been a very dramatic scene. God is making his presence known. And this, really, for the first time, God is overtly making his presence known to them more directly than he has before he's gone through Moses. Then this curious exchange in the last few verses, God tells Moses to go down and to warn the people lest they come up to the mountain and touch it. Apparently, Moses' response is, they are going to come up. I told them they can't. Moses says, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou didst warn us, saying, Set the bounds about the mountain and consecrate it." But God wants to impress upon them the seriousness of this. And he says, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break forth upon them." So God is really impressing upon them the seriousness of this matter, the holiness of this mountain, the significance of this event, and the people must not come onto the mountain. And Moses went down and told the people what God had told them to tell him. This must have been a really dramatic event. You would think that this would have really made an impression upon them, to see God demonstrate his presence so dramatically and so forcefully. And what he's doing here is he's preparing for giving them the law. He has shown himself to the people, and now he's going to tell them what he requires of them, and that's what we'll be looking at next week. When he gives this law, he really has two goals in mind. One is to lay out the principle of right and wrong that he wants them to abide by. A standard of morality, a standard of right conduct. What is just and what is unjust? What's moral and what's immoral? So that's half of what he's doing in the law. The other half of what he's doing in the law is he's giving them customs that will make them into a nation. God is doing something in a very short period of time that historically has taken a long time to occur. And that is a nation to come into existence. a people that all see their identity with one another. And usually that identity is forged over a period of shared history, shared experiences, shared customs developed over time, in which they come to identify with each other because they have all of this shared heritage and background. God is bringing about that same thing in a very compressed period of time. And one of the ways that he's done that is to bring them through this period of the exile, which gives them a lot of shared, intense shared experience in a very short period of time. And now with the law, he's going to give them a set of distinctive customs which will set them apart. So that's part of what he's doing in the law as well. There are these two things: what is right and wrong, and what are the customs of my people. So he is revealing to them his moral nature, and he is making them into a common culture, a culture, a people unto himself. And why does he want to make them into a people unto himself? Because he has this special purpose for them. They are going to be the priesthood to mankind. They are going to serve this special role in humanity, and that is as a mediating people between God and the rest of mankind. And as such, they need to be a holy people, a people that can enter into God's presence on behalf of the rest of mankind. Now, this has been significant in my thinking because it helps to understand then the law. Why do we have some of the bizarre kinds of injunctions in the law intermingled with very commonsensical kinds of instructions with respect to morality? And I think this provides the answer, that God was doing two things in the law. He's revealing his moral nature on the one hand, but on the other hand, he is creating a distinctive people for himself with their own culture and customs. So as we go through the law, you can see the two things side by side, sometimes two in the same injunction, combined in the same injunction. But I think what we need to keep in mind is God has two purposes in mind that are all woven together in this same law. Okay, any comments, questions, Logan?
What exactly are they expected to mediate?
Well, I would assume that all I can do is rely upon the picture that God has created. In order to understand what the relationship of Israel is to the rest of mankind, I think we have to understand what the relationship of the Levitical priesthood is to the nation of Israel. And the Levitical priesthood, its function was to seek out and proclaim to the people the will of God on the one hand, and on the other hand, to enter into God's presence and ask that the people of Israel be made acceptable to God. So my assumption would be that they would serve that same role with respect to mankind as a whole. That they would proclaim to us, the rest of mankind, God's will, and that they would request on the part of mankind that we be made acceptable to him, to God.
So it's an evangelism role, but it's not a mystical intercessory role, like offering up sacrifices for atonement for that people, praying for God's, you know what I'm saying? They weren't go-betweens for any of God's mercies or graces for people, or were they?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there's a sense in which they are, it seems to me. I mean, what we would have to do is look at very carefully, what did the Levitical priesthood do? My understanding is that their role was, on the one hand, to clarify for the people of Israel what God wanted of them, and on the other hand, to perform a service to intercede on behalf of the people of Israel before God for forgiveness of sins. And my presumption is that the nation of Israel as a whole, that that's what God singled them out to do with respect to mankind in general, is to serve that same function. Mm-hmm. Larry?
It seems like what God is doing here in terms of communicating this other-than-ness to his people, and how he communicates that and what he expects of them and how he wants them to think about him on a number of levels is really a precursor to us and God. In the New Testament, I believe.
Right. Do you want to repeat that? Well, Larry's saying that a lot of what God is doing here in communicating to Israel holiness and otherliness and God's his sacredness is really picked up on in the New Testament and taught to us as well, but in a different fashion. That's basic, and I think that's exactly right. I'm really convinced that it is crucial for us to understand who God is in fact. That it is very possible to worship God and to acknowledge a Jesus Christ, neither of which ever existed, a God and a Jesus Christ that did not exist, rather than the ones that really do exist, if you can understand what I'm saying. And that has been done in the past. And in fact, one of the things that's been striking to me in looking through 1st and 2nd Kings, I've been reading through those books with the kids, something that I did not realize before is Israel never did stop worshiping God, Yahweh. But what they did is they worshiped Yahweh and other gods, or they worshiped Yahweh in the way that other people worshiped other gods. So I'm sure if you were to go back in a time capsule and talk to them, they say, we worship Yahweh, but God treated them as though they were of pagans, that they had ignored him. And in fact, they had. They were just worshiping Yahweh by name, but not the Yahweh that was. So it's extremely important for us to get things straight. Who is God and what is his nature? Rather than to create some fiction which doesn't correspond to reality or to God's revelation. I am further convinced that there is much that we believe about God that we have inherited from times past that does not square with Scripture. One huge influence is Greek philosophy. Very early on in the Christian church had a huge impact on Christian theology. And I think for the worse, for the most part. But there are certain concepts that we have inherited as a result of that. And I think the only way to free ourselves from that and to check ourselves and figure out what is the real God and what is not is to pour ourselves back into, and in particular the Old Testament, into where these concepts of holiness are laid out in this manipulative fashion, in these things that you can see and touch and feel, in ritual, in customs that God gave to the people of Israel so that they could develop an understanding for the abstract holiness. Because it's only with after working with manipulatives for a while that you can come to learn what 2 plus 3 is without looking at any objects. Similarly, God built into the culture of Israel a lot of these manipulatives, these visual aids, these things to help us understand concepts that are then used in the New Testament, assuming that we know what those concepts stand for, what they are. And I think a huge task before the church in our time is to go back to the Old Testament and try to clarify what are these concepts more precisely, and therefore, how then do they are they being used in the New Testament?
In the Jewish church, the New Testament, I can see how those manipulated those rituals would easily be passed on from the Jewish, someone who was a convert to the Jewish heritage. In a lot of the Greek churches, they wouldn't have had that. They wouldn't have known anything about that. And if they were so important as information, then why are they not stressed more in the New Testament than they are? I mean, I don't really see a lot of ritual in the New Testament.
Right.
And the thing that always strikes me about religion is in the Old Testament, as it is true today, it all looks very much like all the secular and pagan influences around us. I'm sure what I've read about ancient religions going up to a mountain, it was not that foreign from Babylonian religion, or the Aztecs, any of that. And so I can see an argument saying that this Jehovah and what he is giving to the people really is nothing more than
typical
of the day, as
is today. Okay, let me see if I can remember and answer. There are several issues you're raising, see if I can get them all. First of all, that's absolutely right. That the customs that God gave to the people of Israel were not all that bizarre with respect to the cultures of the time. A lot of them are very similar. And yet, God is, much like he has done throughout history, God is taking human language and giving it his own content. He's using his own, he puts them together in, he takes words that everyone uses, but then he puts those words in a way that communicates his own message to us. And I think that's what he did in the customs of Israel. He took customs that had significance even in the time, but he puts them together in a way that presents a different picture than the picture that was presented by the surrounding religions. So I don't think it's strange then that the religion of the Israelites in a sense fits in with the religions of the time. It's just like God speaking our language to us in our day and age. Now, with respect to the early church, I think that the Jews who converted to Christianity were in an advantageous position, that they were in a position, because of their background and culture, better able to understand the concepts that Jesus and the apostles were building on. There was a problem in Jewish culture at the time, however, in that they had seen the ritual, they had come to see, they had abstracted incorrectly from what God had given them, in a sense. They had seen godliness elsewhere than where it really was. They had misunderstood some of the pictures that God had painted with those rituals. And as a result, Jesus was responding to that and saying, you've misunderstood at the heart what the law is, and we'll talk more about that next week. So there was something that had to be corrected in the Jewish thinking with respect to the gospel. Greeks, I think, could have benefited greatly from absorbing a lot of the culture of this, of Jewish Christians. But very early in the church, a divide occurred between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. And they wouldn't have anything to do with each other. And so there ceased, very shortly, there ceased to be an interchange between the two groups. And the Gentiles became suspicious of the Jews as to whether they were Christians or not. And so that rift developed, and as a result, the Gentile church developed without the benefit of Jewish culture. I think it's a very unfortunate thing that happened in retrospect. But that's the way things evolved. And I think that accounts for some of what we see even in the church today. The lack of that influence of Jewish culture. In fact, very early on, the Old Testament was disdained to a large extent by theologians in the Christian church. Many of them questioned whether it was God's word at all.
If I've understood you correctly, you're suggesting that God introduced this ritual and custom to the Jewish nation to sort of make them into a nation, and there was some real reason to introduce those kinds of customs and rituals into that nation. To sort of go on a little bit of a tangent, we as a church have sort of abandoned a lot of the rituals and customs of the church that exists today. And I was wondering if there's any place for ritual and custom in the church today, and if so, what would it be?
Well, what I mean by God, a people has to have a shared history and shared customs. In order, what a people is a group that says, I am associated with those rather than those. And on what basis do they do that? There's a sense of commonality, something shared. And historically, what is it? It's customs and it's history. It's a shared way of looking at the life, a shared way of living. And so what God did in the Exodus and now in the giving of the law is, in a very short period of time, he kind of in a greenhouse situation, hothouse situation, he's bringing this into being. Well, there's a sense in which just by associating with one another, we're developing our own culture. I think if you were to take a stranger and bring them in here and sit them in here, they would sense a differentness, for better or for worse. You don't know? Well, it is true that in some respects we have consciously made ourselves less church-like in feel and culture. But in doing so, you create another kind of feel. And I think people would sense there's a sense in which we have our own culture.
So we have our own ritual already? Or our own customs and
stuff? To a certain extent, yes. Now, your question is, should there be something more... Should we foster the development of controlled kinds of traditions or customs?
I don't know if that's my question or not, but go ahead and answer
the question. Well, I'd rather not. I don't know how to answer that question. It's really hard to create customs. There seems to be a movement to do so in families. You can get all these books that tell you how to create traditions or things in your family. To a certain extent that can be done, but there's something lost, because how do you make a tradition? You don't make a tradition. A tradition is what you receive. It's not something you make. And by making it, it's something other than a tradition. Well, you can start a practice that can eventually become a tradition. And that's, we've done some of that in our family, done certain things that we've carried on from one year to the next. And I think that can be done. The importance of this And I think that's something that we should think about as far as what is the role of that in the life of human beings, tradition and ritual. Our culture has, for the most part, done away with such things. We have a minimum of that. Other cultures have had a lot of that. And ritual can be, it can enrich a culture. But I, going back to the Old Testament, what God was doing was not the rituals that he was establishing all had a didactic function. And he wants to teach certain things that later on he's going to build on in communicating to us who he is and what the world is all about. And so those were very important at that stage. I don't know if one could use that same rationale in our time, but even if one could not use that same rationale in our time, ritual has been a part of human activity for so long, it's hard to believe that it doesn't have some inherent value to us. I need to quit. I'm sorry. Thank you.